Welcome to the David Yosefon Podcast. I'm David Yosefon. I'm the Peter Canisius S.J. Professor of Law at Santa Clara University School of Law. You can find all my writings, podcasts, and other work on my website at davidyosefon.com. There you will also find contact information if you want to drop me a line. In this episode of the podcast, I wanted to provide an audio version of an essay that I published in the Fordham Law Review in 2020 called Corporate Law as an Existential Project. This essay was the first piece of a broader project that I have undertaken in which I am endeavoring to excavate from fiduciary discourses insights that might be useful for more personal ethics and personally transformative projects. Subsequent to this essay, I have written other articles that extend this work, and you will find links to them on my website. Perhaps I will provide audio versions of some of those subsequent articles in later episodes. But for now, it's Corporate Law as an Existential Project. Epigrams. Problems of welfare economics must ultimately dissolve into a study of aesthetics and morals. Ronald Coase, The Problem of Social Cost. Quote, true enough, thought I, old black letter, thou reasonest well. Herman Melville, Moby Dick. Introduction. We yearn for meaning, but its material is hard to source. Once trusted suppliers are now examples of suspect ones. Religion is not believable. Art is sublime but not operational. Politics is patronizing. The culture all around is a mess. Baseball is gone to analytics. Material progress advances, formal ethical analysis advances, but the human spirit lags behind. This is a problem of the greatest importance. To concern ourselves with meaning is no luxury endeavor. It is a core need. Without it, human beings suffer terribly and die miserably. Law is no panacea, but it is undervalued as a source of value. This essay proposes that corporate law in particular can be a potent resource for the formation of meaning in our minds and in our lives. Here, I am not after the meaning of life in the sense of coming to a certain substantive conclusion, e.g., the meaning of life is 42. Our modern conception is that the meaning of life is not to be found in the form of a singular answer. Our search for significance is not the pursuit of a destination, but is instead a journey, a process, that continually makes meaning as we undertake it. Here I pursue a practical search for meaning as a sense of life that gives us a working favor over nihilism and despair, boredom and nothingness. I am concerned with trying out an approach to thinking about and feeling life which can generate engagement, interest, energy, enthusiasm, and happiness. In a word, meaning. Section 1. Why Corporate Law? Our institutions constrain us. That is one of the primary functions, for example, of law as social contract. But our institutions also enable us to transcend personal limitations that we could not get past on our own. Law, for example, again, can enliven people in non-coercive, personally liberating ways. In the jargon of contemporary legal theory, law can be morally enabling by providing a menu of ethical possibilities, which become salient and encouraging through the majesty of law's presence and credibility. An older vocabulary would say that the law is enmeshed with paideic qualities. Aristotle said that tragedy shows humanity as better than it is, and comedy as worse. When we see ourselves in the latter and shudder, the former gives us a path to turn to after the laughter gives out. This, I think, is true of the fiduciary law I explore here. Its dictates describe a way of life that is more impressive than the lives lived by those who come to it. But having come to it, we may get better than we were. Much of what I have to say here relates to the agency law dimensions of corporate law. A comprehensive exploration of these themes would need to canvas the full expanse of the fiduciary realm. But I regard it as especially important and potent to conceive of this existential project as being about corporate law. First, corporations are fundamental, powerful institutions in our civilization today. They therefore are, or ought to be, at the core of our concerns about how society is operating, what is wrong with it, and what we want to be better. Any existential project that does not address the corporation near to its heart threatens to be nostalgic or escapist. A long tradition of secular humanists have drawn on religious canon to formulate and express secular, even anti-religious insights. I draw here on the liturgy of corporate law to make personal, even anti-corporate, ethical contributions to our postmodern existential predicament. We live in a corporate world, so we will use it. Because corporate law is controversial, it has the attention both of its supporters and detractors. This attention can be nudged to adjacent concerns. If you love corporate law already, this project will let that love run deeper and make it more personally actionable than is suggested by canonical corporate law discourses. If you hate corporate law, I will show some depths of its power that may change your way of thinking about it. I will also suggest how that power can be redirected to change corporate law for the better. Finally, it is the mysterious nature of the corporation which makes it an especially attractive site for existential inquiry. We who have thought hard about it cannot even say once and for all what a corporation is, or in what sense it should be said to exist. Here I drop a footnote, 11. I obviously will not give all footnotes in this piece, but from time to time I'll reference them. Here I drop a footnote to Pierre Schlag, The Aesthetics of American Law, in the Harvard Law Review, 2002. Quote, "At other times, the corporation thing falls away, and we experience a kind of ontological crash. We have lost the identity of the thing we were supposedly talking about." See also generally John Dewey, The Historic Background of Corporate Legal Personality. Compare the ineffability of the corporation to the strong, intuitive conceptions that we have of contract or real property. See Joan Williams, The Rhetoric of Property, describing and critiquing the intuitive idea of real property in the Iowa Law Review in 1988. Back to the text. We who have thought hard about it cannot even say once and for all what a corporation is, or in what sense it should be said to exist. Yet we know that it is powerful. Like all human creations, the corporation must reflect something of ourselves. We look to the corporation because it has been so successful. There must be something in its design that is useful. We look to the corporation because it is so destructive. there must be some warning within it that we must tell ourselves. It is not my intention here to assess corporate law as it operates, quote, in the trenches, close quote, or the tranches. Instead, I want to encourage an interpretation of corporate law, a way of being moved by corporate law that can help us to a better life, a better sentiment of life. In Moby Dick, the narrator Ishmael says that it is the French painters who best capture the spirit of the whale hunt in action, even though the French have far less presence in the whale fishery than do the Americans or the British. American painters miss the essence of whaling, he implies, not despite but because of their immersion in the industry. American paintings are too technically and mechanically precise to raise the deeper truths of what whaling is all about. So too may legal theory say what corporate law is like without detailing the particulars of the darted irons and the bloody spray. Ethics must address the practical world through perspectives and categories that are outside of it. Otherwise, it risks patronizing the world it really wants to engage. There is more in corporate law than bread alone. We must consecrate its spiritual use. This is not to say that corporate law has an exclusive claim to excellence as an existential device. It is only to say that it is a promising one. There is not just one way of making things good or making things awful, and so there is a moral landscape with many peaks and valleys. Footnote to Sam Harris, The Moral Landscape, 2010. I mean this as an experiment that might be undertaken in other areas of law and other areas of professional and social life. This project is an existential reconnoiter of the mountain of corporate law, a high mountaintop which, once climbed, will reveal its top as a false peak. We can go still higher. This essay explores corporate law as a source for generating meaning in the course of a good individual life. But the personal is political. The resource that I aim to unleash has broad normative potential. If tapped, it could yield the vision and energy required to achieve a reform of law, and corporate law in particular, that might render it more socially and existentially desirable. Wanting to know what corporate law can do for me or you is wrapped up in the question of what we can do and might better know how to do for society. Section 2. It is about connection. We cannot say what it is like, for example, to be a bat. Footnote, Thomas Nagel, What Is It Like to Be a Bat, 1974. Back to the texts. For humans, we can say, or dare say. With Roberto Unger, I quote, gamble on the idea that we can develop an account of our basic human identity that is neither trivial nor fatally beholden to the preconceptions of a particular culture. Close quote. We can start by understanding that for us, the most important meaning emerges in the course of our relationships with other people. No person is an island entire of itself. Poets, anthropologists, psychologists, sociologists, theologians, artists, the full ecumenical, quote, priesthood of the imagination, close quote, agree that the answer, an answer, to existential dread lies in the creation of meaning through the ways we connect with others. This is why Sartre said, hell is other people. Terrible as everyone is, there is really no escaping them. except into something worse. Worse is the dehumanization of isolation. What we are primarily concerned with is other people. If we are to have meaning, and improved meaning in our lives, we must be, quote, involved in mankind, close quote. Corporate law can show us how. In an important article, Peter Gabel argued that while we have a core desire for union and intimacy with others, we are afraid of this desire. We avoid, evade, and undermine it, he claimed. And we do so especially through law. Gabel's idea is that law and legal relationships function as a framework, a thing in consciousness, around which we execute our intention to divert from our core desire for intimacy and instead present ourselves to each other in less vulnerable ways. We insert legal institutions into our imaginations in order to conceive of our alienation as dictated and, quote, official, close quote. Making our alienation official both explains it and gives us a masochistic confidence that it will always be there. According to Gabel, this, quote, conspiracy of withdrawn selves, close quote, can be seen in, for lawyers, quote, their glassy eyes and rigid posture, close quote, or in the slight delays in speech by which other people assure us, quote, that they are in some sense not here with us, close quote. Gabel rues this widespread conspiracy because it causes so much of our lives to, quote, lack any sense of the immediacy and contingency of truly lived encounters, close quote. My view is really the reverse of Gabel's. Our desire for meaning is too massive and unbound, and our creativity too unstructured, and our minds too cluttered to concretize our yearning for connection and relation on our own. So we do it through existential mediating hierarchs, to borrow a phrase, among which is legal imagination. Gabel claims we deny our desire for connection by hiding in roles that the law makes official. My point is the opposite. We are clumsy and shy and unartful. But through our legal imagination, we can conceive of roles and feed on lines that facilitate connection. We need this mechanism of encounter, and we have it. I promise that this is not to say that we must have in our workplaces or elsewhere open floor plans or FaceTime or meetings or coffees or lunches or chit-chat. Anyone can have those things if they want them, but you do not need them for this existential project. Corporate existentialism is not against being alone. It is only against loneliness. This is not really about professional arrangements. It is about how we think and feel about our lives. I am talking about an ethics, an approach to consciousness, imagination, and a sentiment of being. This is happening only in your mind, and you may also find it happening in your life. Section 3, Getting After It. While corporate theorists ponder about what the corporation is, the corporate law gets right into the process of becoming by specifying in Section 141A of the Delaware General Corporation Law that, quote, the corporation shall be managed by a board of directors. If meaning is found through engagement, through iteration, then the injunction to move, to do it, is a first ethical principle of a good existential project. And this first principle is well elaborated in corporate law. The fact that corporate boards have a duty to act is one of the reasons corporations are so often more effective than natural people. Corporations have to be managed, while people often abide a vacancy in the central offices. This simple principle describes a core ethic of a good life. You cannot just sit there like a lump on a log. Do not regard this as merely enabling or as clarifying that you may be managed. There is more in it than that. Private ordering will come. There will be plenty of chances to choose your own way. But you will not have occasion to forge your own path until you are moving. Yet neither is this quite command. Quote, shall be managed, close quote, is prophecy. The duty of care is the self-fulfilling prophecy of corporate existentialism. This injunction to act must be regarded as opportunity rather than burdensome responsibility. It gives escape from slothfulness, a condition we call sinful because it is corrupting to what is beautiful and tending toward the divine in humanity. Like all sinners, the sloth is ultimately a pitiable figure. Whatever private, professional, or social responsibilities she neglects, the worst of it she suffers herself in, quote, the pain of idleness. Footnote, Bob Dylan, Every Grain of Sand, 1981. Melville's Bartleby the Scrivener, who, quote, prefers not to, close quote, undertake the duties of the magistrate's office in which he is employed and does not undertake them, is not happy. His eyes are glazed. He is miserable, neurotic, and finally dies of his nothingness. A human being managing their life does not lose energy, but rather gains it. Emerson knew, quote, power resides in the moment of transition from a past to a new state, in the shooting of the gulf, in the darting to an aim, close quote. With just a mustard seed of shall be managed, you can move mountains, or at least begin a climb and give your dinner the seasoning of appetite. More than potent, trying is joyful. The face of oomph is a smile, or better. Quote, energy is eternal delight, wrote Mr. Blake. This is the secret profit of agency that cannot be disgorged. In this existential project, we see coming and then duck the hard questions concerning freedom of will, as against deterministic forces. Are we free to move ourselves, or was it all dictated in the register of the Big Bang? Corporate law gives a practical ethics for practical men and women. We are after meaning, not truth. We can be big in life even if we are little in understanding. So we move at Delaware's command to act and, quote, write on the lintels of the doorpost, whim. I hope it is somewhat better than whim at last, but we cannot spend the day in explanation, close quote. Footnote, Ralph Waldo Emerson. This is audacious, but it is not glib. The inequitably distributed privileges of social status, wealth, birth endowments, and luck make it easier for some people and harder for some people to go. This existential project is not a programmatic response to, and certainly not a reconciliation with, established distributions of power and capability. This is a personal ethics for the creation of meaning in the shadow of prevailing arrangements, which meaning might enable a reformative impulse to emerge out of the shadow and strike for social justice. Neither is this a substitute for healthcare. I am addressing a sentiment of being in whatever idiom ethics properly operates distinctly from the realm of medical diagnosis and treatment. Readers suffering from depression or other mental illnesses are urged to seek medical attention. Humbly, it is my hope that they may find in this essay some resource of persistence that may aid them to keep seeking it, despite finding, as may be likely under current arrangements, that it is hard to get. Section 3A, Non-Judgment. Among the hallowed precepts of corporate law is the business judgment rule. Under this rule, corporate directors who make deliberate, unconflicted business decisions are insulated from personal liability, though the decision turns out badly or even disastrously for the firm. Directors are not held to a standard of ordinary prudence. If they meet the standards of the business judgment rule, they can make unusual, offbeat, or weird choices that differ from industry norms without exposing themselves to a stickable charge of wrongdoing. The idea of the business judgment rule is existentially promising. We will not say that you should do what most people are doing or what is usually done. We do not say how or where exactly to move. We only say go. Do what you think is best, the best you can, and if you act in good faith, we do not judge you and you will not judge yourself. A crucial component to the business judgment rule is that we only grant its protections if a decision was informed. It is not enough to be properly motivated. You must also make an effort to know and think things through the relevant facts. The world is a certain way. It works in a certain way. We cannot perfectly know it, nor know how our behavior will affect it or the people in it. But we have to make an effort to find out, to understand what is likely to happen, and to base our decisions about our own behavior on our evaluation of the available evidence. We do not have to keep our nose in the social statistics all day, but the responsibility to look and think before we act is a principle of realism, of modernity, that must be satisfied if you are to escape judgmental scrutiny. This responsibility redounds as existential opportunity. To be informed and deliberate, you must be continually engaged with others, making your mind and opinion vulnerable to influence by them, trusting them as you must, if you are going to be open to changing your mind, as you must be open, before you can receive business judgment rule protection. The corporate life, in this sense, is the life of intimacy and vulnerability. And in that kind of life is found the stuff of meaning. Section 3B, Purpose. But what should you be managing yourself for or towards? What I say here might be controversial intellectually, but not practically. The Delaware Corporate Code says, get after it. What corporate directors are supposed to get after is profits for the shareholders. Directors do not have to think about what their purpose is. Instead, they are to spend their time and energy coming up with the means of advancing their purpose. This framework is commendable to the kind of existential project I am developing here. Of course, I do not mean that you should maximize your own wealth, nor is it especially inspiriting to think in terms of maximizing utility or well-being. Instead, what I want to emphasize is that the existential project proposed here does not require you, or even really invite you, to struggle with purpose. You do not need to think too much about the purpose of your life. The purpose is given, more or less. The purpose is as described in the default expectations of our culture. Work hard and honest, be a good friend, spouse, mother, sister, father, brother, son, daughter, citizen, community member, consumer. Relax and be happy, exercise, be socially responsible, worship. Keep your vices in check, but not so much that they manifest as neuroses. That sort of thing. An existential project, or this existential project, should be concerned with surfacing the means to pursue these default purposes. The point is that people should not really see their existential task as figuring out the purpose of their life. Rather, they should regard the path to meaning as running through the course of discovering the best means, their best means, towards accomplishing the purpose that is implicit in what they are as humans in this society. Now, as to this, there must be freedom of escape. As in corporate law, people can widely deviate even from the core default rules and establish whatever heterodox purpose they desire. But they must do so explicitly. Otherwise, they will be held by others and will hold themselves to the ordinary standard and will suffer confusion, despondency, and misery within the conventional idiom. There are forms of life that allow for maximal private ordering. However, there is greater risk in them. They are less tried, and many people will be reluctant to invest in or deal easily with you unless you share the default ideas concerning what life is all about. Section 3C, Loyalty. A principle must risk being used or manipulated if it would chance to gain the benefits that a faithful agent can deliver. The duty of loyalty is the generative salve we put on this gash of vulnerability in fiduciary relationships. Corporate law prescribes a duty of loyalty that compels directors to put the interests of the corporation and its shareholders first and to not allow their own self-interest to get in the way of serving the corporate purpose. This kind of giving and receiving of loyalty may ready us for the deeper responsibilities and opportunities that more intimate vulnerability can present. The law's most hallowed exposition of the duty of loyalty comes from the case of Meinhardt versus Salmon, in which Judge Benjamin Cardozo wrote that a fiduciary owes to their charge, quote, not honesty alone, but the punctilio of an honor the most sensitive, and that fiduciary loyalty requires, quote, thought of self to be renounced, however hard the abnegation. Meinhardt and Salmon were partners in a real estate venture. Near the end of the lease on their property, Salmon, the managing partner, arranged a new deal in his own name, on his own account, to develop the property and adjacent land under a new lease. Meinhardt sued, alleging a fiduciary violation, and Cardozo held that Salmon breached his duty of loyalty in taking the new deal for himself. It was turned over to their partnership. In an essay asking, must Salmon love Meinhardt? Professor Stephen Bainbridge answers in the negative, finding decisive limits to loyalty obligations in agency law doctrine that do not require agapic, self-sacrificing love from the agent to the principal. Quote, so much for renouncing thought of the self, writes Bainbridge. If agape is not actually the standard, then what is the agapic language doing in this touchstone opinion? Bainbridge concludes that it sets out an aspirational ideal, as Delaware opinions often do today, praising or condemning corporate directors' conduct, even where formal liability is not implicated. For our existential purpose, I want us to regard this kind of fiduciary dicta as an invitation to and an incantation of the deep power that is available if we give ourselves over to the loyalty relationship. Quote, cast your dancing spell my way. I promise to go under it. Bob Dylan, Mr. Tambourine Man, 1965. This is to say that among the good pleasures is the big, meaningful feeling of loyalty. Not the receipt of it, but the giving of it. Such is the strange alchemy of loyalty that it pays back to the soul more than it costs the ego. The great educator Booker T. Washington understood this effect. In Up From Slavery, he wrote, quote, few things help an individual more than to place responsibility upon him and to let him know that you trust him. Close quote. There is personal power to be gained not in the slack of the agency relationship, but in the torque of loyalty given hard and true. This is the truth of the human condition. Quote, every individual responds to confidence. Close quote. Booker T. Washington, Up From Slavery. The commitment to putting something before ourselves does not diminish us. It elevates us. Loyalty does not just forbid us from our narrow self-interest, it liberates us from it. We look in the mirror and see what we were meant to be. Washington, born into slavery, generated his insight in the conditions of extreme deprivation that attended emancipation. He found a key to human nature that can generate meaning even within desolation. By requiring us to restrain ourselves, the duty of loyalty gives us a better idea of what we really are and what is worthwhile about us. This reaches at the deeper philosophical questions, and corporate law helps us grasp the answers. Just as our moral wisdom says there is no single meaning of life, but instead that meaning emerges through processes, so too does our best wisdom say there really is no single constant you, no singular self to be discovered and vindicated once and for all. This is what the Buddhists, the postmodernists, and the social psychologists all say. The sense of a core and abiding dispositional self is an illusion, an ephemeral subjectivity generated by the unmoored discourses that thought dreams pass through our minds. There is no inveterate, unchanging ground of authentic selfhood to stand firmly on, and the trying to do so is bound to give you vertigo. As the Nobel laureate Bob Dylan has repeatedly emphasized, quote, the point of life is not to discover who you are. The point of life is to create who you are, close quote. Polonius is the fool when he says, to thine own self be true. What washes up in the heart or mind is not you and is not necessarily a truth worth having. When we say, be true to yourself, what we really mean is hew to what the black letter says you are, not what you find yourself being in the trenches. By our true self, we really mean our best self, and our best self is archetypal. Restatement visions we may ensoul. Footnote there to Lionel Trilling, who talks about the archetypal self being our best self. Loyalty is a way of getting past yourself as you are and getting instead to something better. It is not just all right, but imperative to escape from yourself in the pursuit of a meaningful life. This is why Oscar Wilde is not just clever, but profound when he writes, quote, the first duty in life is to be as artificial as possible. What the second duty is, no one has yet discovered, close quote. The mask of agency is valuable not because it frees you to say what you really think. The mask is valuable because it frees you from saying what you really think. The importance of being earnest, it turns out, is nil. And as Lionel Trilling concludes, quote, if existence is responded to as if it were less than totally in earnest, spirit is the less bound by it. It can then, without sadness, accept existence and without resentment, transact such business with it as is necessary, close quote. You cannot be free of your authorial self-conception simply by making a philosophically or scientifically grounded decision to ignore it. Getting past yourself is a process. Before you can be free of that fiction, you must first be attentive to it and see it as clearly as you can, the truth of its falsity. In meditation, this is done through quiet, still, focused observation of the thought dreams and disidentifying with them. It can also be accomplished with the use of psychedelics. But meditation is hard for householders, and psychedelics are even harder. The duty of loyalty provides a direct and practicable way out of the illusion of solipsistic self-narration. The introspection required by the law of loyalty helps us to see our narrative selves more clearly and then to understand the fleeting nature of what we see. The fiduciary obligation to confess personal conflicts at first may lend greater reality to those truths, which might otherwise have laid only half alive in our minds. But then the obligation to strike out or constrain these conflicting elements of personality vindicates the truth that they are not really us. We are separate from them and can wear them or put them aside. Quote, the truths of metaphysics are the truths of masks, said Oscar Wilde. But what should we find meaning in loyalty to? To say that you are loyal implies that you are an agent to some principle. I am not exactly reaching here to fortify the particular relationships of your life, although, of course, they can be nourishing when well cultivated. I am trying to show how the loyalty conception can help generate a meaningful sentiment of being in your own head, irrespective of whether you serve on a board, have clients, are married, or coach youth soccer. We're going to do what we do, work, take care of our children, eat, play, sleep, whatever. What is subject to alteration is how we think about it. The liturgy of loyalty, I am urging, can be tapped in the imagination of a way of life. You are vulnerable. You need somebody to trust, and you can trust yourself. Be loyal to your endeavor. Section 4, Transformation, Social Responsibility as Personal Opportunity. This existential project is not complacent. It is not an ideology of the status quo. A big human life must involve openness not just to tinkering, but to transformation. Meaning understood in terms of process, necessarily involves dynamism and possibility. I want to illustrate this with reference to an idea of social responsibility and how it informs and may be served by corporate existentialism. Start with the idea that society is a construct in the deepest sense. What else would it be? Its terms are not discovered under any microscope nor revealed on top of any mountain. The institutions, structures, and types of relationships we have now are not necessary. They are only ever provisional. The truth of this anti-necessitarianism is hard to deny, but harder to believe. We understand it as a formal principle, but are easily lulled into necessitarian thinking by our psychological status quo bias, polemicists, and, quote, the idolatry of the actual, close quote, Roberto Unger. Social responsibility must therefore involve the responsibility to continually remind ourselves and each other about what society is. Quote, the idea of society includes the assumption that a given society can be changed if the judgment passed upon it is adverse, close quote, Lionel Trilling. Second, social responsibility must involve the actual passing of judgment on society. Third, social responsibility must involve some effort to imagine alternatives against which the actual might be evaluated or moved on from. An existential project must be socially responsible in this sense. Otherwise, it cannot produce meaning in our modern terms of process and becoming. Corporate existentialism is socially responsible. Having compelled you to be diligent and loyal, it has made you sober, healthy, and potent. Having thrown off the shackles of self-interest and empowered by the mysterious energy of loyalty, you are freed to transform from where you were. If we are to be socially responsible, in the sense I have defined it here, our fiduciary commitments must have limits. We must be poised to be disloyal to the meanings in which we are involved. We must encourage in ourselves not the, quote, heroism of dumb service, close quote, Trilling, but agency as a mask, a loose mask, which can be taken off in favor of another mask, a new mask that is more meaningful to us. Here is where the core corporate law principle of volunteerism plays its crucial role. Notice, I did not emphasize it at the beginning. There, the focus was on the injunction, shall act, shall act. But corporate law also requires that you be voluntarily engaged in the meaning you are making. The elements of corporate life are always provisional, are only a mask, because of the rule that agency relationships must be voluntary. This voluntarism is prior to and supersedes the duty of loyalty. This is to say, you can always breach, and maybe you should. The future, quote, cannot be colonized in advance, Gable. The power and vulnerability dictated by the fiduciary opportunities of care and loyalty may generate any kind of new, unexpected meaning. And if it is heretical to fiduciary scriptures, so be it. Something very different, very bold may come out. Law is not the destination. Law is the path. What should corporate law become? Who are you becoming? Beyond authorizing transformation, the approach adopted here can also help to enliven and quicken the transformative impulse. Earlier, I discussed Gable's idea that the law works in our imagination to make our alienation seem official and therefore unalterable to our shallow satisfaction but deeper dismay. If that does happen, then it is a badly educated legal imagination that allows it to happen. An existential project committed to exploiting meaning available in corporate law can show the falsity of the conception that Gable laments as so widespread. From a corporate law perspective, legal relationships are clearly not permanent and unalterable. You do not choose your family, and you barely choose your friends, but your fiduciary affections are voluntary. Corporate existentialism can tutor dynamism and counsel means and meanings of escape in other areas of life. Gable says that we use the law to represent, quote, our false selves as legally compelled, close quote. But I am emphasizing the core elements of voluntariness in agency law, the opportunity for exit. With this knowledge in your head, you cannot lapse into reveries of compulsory alienation. Unger says that, quote, our ideals and interests are nailed to the cross of the institutions and practices that represent them in fact. The law is the site of this crucifixion, close quote. But Golgotha is a holy place, not an evil place. It is the place where redemption and renewal are initiated, not despite, but through the crucifixion. Thank you for listening to this audio version of Corporate Law as an Existential Project. I hope you've enjoyed it. Again, you can find the written version at Volume 88, Fordham Law Review, 1801, 2020. If you enjoyed this or didn't enjoy it, would love to hear your thoughts. Again, you can contact me through my website at davidyosefon.com. Thank you for listening. I've enjoyed reading it to you, and I look forward to the next episode.